Hello, gas passers, and welcome back to another episode of the North American Veterinary Anesthesia Society podcast, sponsored by DECRA. I am your host and self-declared proud gas passer, Dr. Bonnie Gatson. Our mission with this podcast is to explore the latest advancements and hot topics in veterinary anesthesia to help anesthesia professionals and caregivers advance and improve the safe administration of anesthesia and analgesia to all animals. And because the mission of NAVAS is focused on continuing education, we decided to bring you an entire episode just about that, education and training. But first, I want to thank our sponsor, DECRA, who makes this podcast possible. The folks at DECRA allow us here on the NAVAS podcast to bring you anesthesia-related content that we feel benefits the veterinary community, and they fully support us in that educational mission. We encourage you to please check out their line of veterinary anesthesia-related products at www.decra-us.com. So a few years back, even before I did my anesthesia residency training, there was a wonderful book I read by Malcolm Gladwell called Outliers. If you've not read it or really read any of Mr. Gladwell's books, I strongly encourage you to do so. All of his books are excellent. But in this book, Outliers, he argues that in order to obtain mastery in any skill, you would need to practice, albeit correctly, for 10,000 hours. As far as anesthesia is concerned, that would mean that even if you did nothing in your 40-hour work week but anesthetize animals, it would take you almost 5 years to completely master the subject. And albeit I have an anesthesia consulting business, so generally, people are seeking me out when they want anesthesia help. But one of the most frequent questions I get asked is, what can I do to learn anesthesia so we can help our patients better, even when you're not here? We get some anesthesia training in veterinary school or in technician training programs, but anesthesia is a skill that requires a mastery in a very specific set of technical skills, as well as critical thinking skills that need to be accessed swiftly so that anesthetists can effectively troubleshoot problems as they arise before resulting in significant patient harm. Now, on top of possibly feeling somewhat insecure about your own personal anesthesia skills, last year, the American Animal Hospital Association released their recommendations for utilizing veterinary technicians. These recommendations include many skills with a range of difficulties related to anesthesia, from low-level skills like endotracheal intubation and anesthetic monitoring of healthy patients, to more advanced skills like direct blood pressure monitoring. These recommendations now have set up an expectation for veterinary technicians to competently perform a wide range of anesthesia-related skills. So, whether you are feeling not so confident about your level of anesthesia knowledge, or if you are looking to achieve those 10,000 hours needed for skill mastery, this episode is for you. How do we set up ourselves for success to learn the skills and knowledge necessary to become capable and competent in anesthesia? And what are the most effective training modalities to achieve this goal? To help us navigate these questions is a guest that I'm very excited to have on the podcast, Dr. Eric Hoffmeister. Dr. Hoffmeister is a veterinary anesthesiologist that has trained arguably thousands of veterinary students in academia. He has published a countless number of journal articles and contributed to many book chapters where his research focus has been on patient safety in veterinary anesthesia, which I'm sure all of my listeners are now very well aware that I love this topic, but he also has a research focus in the scholarship of teaching and learning and in evidence-based decision-making. He is currently a professor of anesthesiology at Auburn School of Veterinary Medicine, so he is a fantastic guest to help answer some of these questions about anesthesia education and training. So please sit back and enjoy this episode of the NAVAS podcast all about anesthesia education and training. Do you you mind introducing yourself and briefly describe your past training and your current role?
Hello, welcome everyone. I'm Eric Hoffmeister. I'm an anesthesiologist at Auburn University in Auburn, Alabama. I grew up in Los Angeles, California, and went to school, undergrad and vet school at Washington State University up in Pullman. And then after graduation, I did an internship in private practice back in Southern California. And then I actually wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon, but did not match for a residency. And there were some unmatched anesthesia residencies. And I thought, oh, I'll do that for a couple of years and then go to surgery. One of them was at Georgia. So I went to the University of Georgia for my residency and I stayed on there as an anesthesia faculty and decided anesthesia is pretty cool. And then I've also been a department chair at Midwestern University in Phoenix. And I've been here at Auburn for about 5 years.
So I ask all my guests this question. I mean, you said you kind of fell into it, but then you stayed. So what drew you to staying in anesthesia?
I think similar to surgery, you can solve things relatively rapidly. You know, you don't have any asthmatic cats that you're just managing for 5 years of their life, like internal medicine. So yeah, things happen relatively quickly. You either fix it or you don't. And it's a lot more satisfying in that regard. So I think on a fundamental level, that's really the thing that I like about anesthesia.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. I think when I was early in my career, I thought I wanted to specialize in something like oncology or internal medicine. But for the exact same reasons you just pointed out, I like having like rapid feedback and fixing problems quickly. It seems to be less of something you can do in those other specialties.
Yeah, for sure.
So what drew you to veterinary academia? Because it seems like you started your career there and you're still there. So why do you like it there?
So back in the day, I'm a 2000 graduate from vet school. And in the 90s, early 2000s, there were very few private practice anesthesiologists. I can count on one hand the number that were in practice when I was finishing my residency. So it was pretty much assumed that if you do anesthesia, you go into academia. And now obviously that's totally flipped. There's a ton of people in private practice. It's a great way to get into a private practice career. But yeah, back in the day, it was pretty much you're going to be an academic. So that was one thing. And then the other thing is I really like teaching. I've been teaching, you know, pretty much my whole life. Like I think I was 12 years old and helping one of my karate instructors, you know, at one of his branch schools. So I've always enjoyed teaching. And it's a great opportunity to do that. And I also really enjoy research. And I've actually gotten to enjoy research more and more over years. So teaching, clinics, research, that's kind of your classic academic role.
So the reason I have you on the podcast today is really because of your interests in education. And I really wanted to speak with you today specifically about anesthesia training. So you have a long history of teaching students, residents, technicians, and I feel like you at this point have a hunch as far as what works and what doesn't work when it comes to educating people in anesthesia. And as I'm sure you know, in most veterinary practices, sedating and anesthetizing animals is most often performed by veterinary technicians under the supervision of a veterinarian, of course. And last year, the American Animal Hospital Association released their recommendations for skills that can be performed by veterinary technicians, which included many skills with a range of difficulties relating to anesthesia. We're talking low-level skills like tracheal intubation, monitoring healthy patients under anesthesia, more advanced skills like placing arterial catheters or even performing ultrasound-guided nerve blocks. So with these technician utilization guidelines, there's an expectation for veterinary technicians to possess really a wide range of anesthesia-related skills. So with that, our goal really today is to talk about how veterinary technicians can get these skills and how they can improve themselves related to feeling more confident in performing anesthesia. And so I kind of want to start first with veterinarians. And as my listeners know by now, I have an anesthesia consulting business, so I very regularly speak with veterinarians who feel really insecure about their anesthesia knowledge. And mind you, you know, I'm probably only speaking to vets who don't feel comfortable with anesthesia, so I probably have like a biased view on this topic. But, you know, you've taught hundreds, if not like thousands, of veterinary students in anesthesia. And yet when I speak to many young graduates in my business, there are many veterinary professionals that express concerns about their gaps in their skill level or their knowledge base. And this, of course, also applies to veterinary technicians. But really, like, why do you think it is that a general practitioner or a veterinary technician might feel less confidence in their anesthesia skills? Like, where is that knowledge gap really coming from, or at least their feelings of a lack of confidence in anesthesia?
My diagnosis of this problem is that we as educators are making it too complicated. And this is probably an unpopular opinion in a lot of ways. But yeah, I think that we're making it too complicated, and we're expecting them to have a knowledge level and competence and expertise that you just don't need for general practice. The example that comes to mind for me is, like, you know, students are always like, okay, can you talk to us about anesthetizing patients with cardiac disease? And I'm like, all right, I'm going to make this real simple. You guys got a little white fluffy dog with a heart murmur. It's fine. Carry on. Right. Do that in practice. No worries. If you've got a cat with HCM or a Doberman with really bad DCM, you might want to send that somewhere else, because that's what they need to know. You know, it's like, what do I need to worry about? What is normal? What's abnormal? We don't need to get into all the esoterica. Like, I'm not going to tell you how to anesthetize a DCM dog. Like, it's not useful for you in practice for the most part. You know, send that somewhere else or call up your local anesthesiologist and be like, hey, I have this case. But they're not going to retain that information over the next 10 years between when they graduate and when they're going to use it. So I think that we make it too complicated. We got to just simple it down.
So based off of that philosophy, whereby you feel like we're just making anesthesia way too complicated in an academic setting, what do you think would be the minimum competency level for an individual to start performing anesthesia without, like, direct supervision? Like, maybe there's a veterinarian around or, like, an experienced technician nearby if there's, like, assistance needed. But what types of skills do you feel are essential to master for the purpose of performing anesthesia?
So first of all, the question of mastery, I think, is an important one to take a moment to think about and define. So, you know, when we think about expertise, so I did a master's degree in sport pedagogy, and the lab that I worked in spent a lot of time thinking about expertise, specifically with golf instructors, but it can be applied, you know, to any discipline, especially if it's psychomotor skills like intubation or placing an IV catheter. Expertise is complicated. And so I think that rather than mastery, I would say competence is kind of my target slash goal. So in terms of competence, what I want for the vet students, and I'll modify this a little bit for the technicians, but what I want for the vet students is I want them to be able to safely anesthetize a routine case for, like, a spay or neuter or dental, like the things they're going to do in practice. So that includes, you know, sedation, IV catheter, induction, intubation, placing monitoring, and then monitoring the patient and recovering the patient. And I would say dealing with common, not uncommon problems. And so I think that it's pretty much a similar list for the technicians. I think that I would say instead of dealing with problems, my expectation would be able to identify when a problem is happening and let the veterinarian know. You know, to be able to distinguish normal from abnormal and be like, okay, no, everything's fine, or something's odd here. Let me let the vet know. So that's kind of what comes to mind for me.
One thing I find that maybe this is true of specialty hospitals, because I work a lot more commonly in specialty hospitals. A lot of specialists would argue with me, like, I would say surgeons or other specialists who are relying on technicians to perform their anesthesia. One of the arguments that gets me a lot of times is that although you're arguing that minimum competency level is recognizing abnormalities, they would probably argue that a minimum competency might be basic troubleshooting. So what would you say about that? Or is it just that technicians are performing, like, maybe more high level anesthesia because they're in a specialty hospital? Does the competency level have a gradient? This is essentially what I'm asking, depending on kind of the situation of where you're working.
Yeah, 100%. You know, I'm thinking more about the tech in practice, in general practice, that's doing a bunch of things, right? They're not just doing anesthesia Monday through Friday. They're also doing room appointments, and maybe they're setting up for surgery. Maybe they're cleaning instruments. Like, this person has so many things that they need to do that they're not going to have the opportunity to have that specialized knowledge to handle, you know, common anesthetic problems, unless that's their interest, right? So if they're members of NAVAS, maybe they are interested in it and, you know, are focusing on that skill set. You know, certainly for the technicians at the university that I work with, I encourage them to handle what I call first order problems. So it's like, okay, you've encountered a problem, like do your best to solve that. And if your like first step is not sufficient, then let me know. So I do want to empower them to do that. You know, you're facing a patient who's tachycardic and their depth seems a little light, try giving a dose of hydro and see what it does, you know, or, you know, give a fluid bolus if they're hypotensive. Like all these things I empower our technicians to do. And in practice, you know, you might get your technicians up to being comfortable with that point. But I would say step number one is recognizing it. And then the other consideration that I would have, I have a friend who's a small animal surgeon in private practice in the Northeast. And so she has her surgery team, you know, they're technicians that do surgery and anesthesia and support her and everything. And she was having a semi-complicated case, you know, I don't know, it was a diaphragmatic hernia or something. And, you know, the technicians were like, oh, we're not quite sure what to do. And she's like, yeah, that's fine. We haven't done one of these before. Like, I don't expect you to know this stuff if you haven't been exposed to it. So that's kind of what comes to me, mind for me is in practice, you're doing spays, you're doing neuters, you're doing mass removals, you're doing biopsies, whatever, dentals. And then like a hind limb amputation comes in. And you as the vet, like it was 3 years since you did your last hind limb amputation, you know? Yeah, I expect that this is going to be more challenging for you. So it's the same thing with the anesthetist. Like you get in your routine, you know how to handle the things that you know how to handle. And then when something weird comes along, you're going to need help. And that's normal.
Yeah, I think that you make a really good point, maybe indirectly, in that there needs to be like a general understanding amongst the team about what we're comfortable and what we're not comfortable in it, and being okay with situations where we're not comfortable. Recognizing that, I think, is huge. And then providing some time for your staff or yourself to get a little bit of a better understanding. Of course, sometimes it doesn't always happen, but allowing like that space for people to say, like, I don't know this is huge, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. And across the board, you know, like sometimes students will ask me something. And I'm like, I don't know, you know, and I've been doing this 20 plus years. So I think that having that humility is really important. And especially, you know, as I think about technician anesthetists, when I talk to them doing CE and whatnot, one of my goals is for them to feel empowered to say to the veterinarian, like, hey, so I haven't run one of these before. Can we talk about it? You know, can we have that conversation? And hopefully you're in a practice that has a positive culture towards that. Because when people make assumptions is when medical errors start happening.
Right. So what do you think is more dangerous as far as a person's ability to perform anesthesia safely? Being overly confident in one's skills and being like unwilling to change, or being extremely timid and not being confident enough in one skill?
I think this is probably going to depend on your personal perception. So I don't think this is across the board. For me, I would rather have the extremely timid person than the overconfident person, even though they're both problematic. The overconfident person is going to make errors and they're not going to learn from them is my main concern. Like medical errors happen. Medicine is complicated. There's a lot of moving parts. You know, this is how it is. But the overconfident person is not going to learn from them and they're not going to get better. The excessively timid, anxious person is going to like have an outsized emotional reaction if something goes wrong, and that may impede their learning. But on a certain level, I think that it will also help motivate them to get better, and hopefully over time they will. So the timid person has an opportunity for growth, whereas the overconfident person doesn't.
Yeah, I kind of agree with your assessment on that. So let's jump into how people learn. So there's a ton of theories out there that have been floated around that describe how people learn new information. I know that you've done, you know, your master's degree in some of these types of theories. So this is like a huge question, but can you condense down like what we know about theories about how people best retain information and learn new skills?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's not an opinion-based thing anymore. We have pretty compelling evidence from neuropsychological studies about how people learn. What I suggest people do is go to learningscientists.com, and they have the evidence-based ways that humans learn. And they also have a visual guide. This is Understanding How We Learn, a visual guide that basically details the ways that humans learn effectively. And it's pretty much known. We know how to do this effectively. And so that's my go-to nowadays is we got the evidence. If we're evidence-based clinicians, we should be evidence-based educators as well. And so going with these approaches is the best way to do it.
We can put a link in the show notes to that website. And also, I know for our listeners, they can't see this. I can, because I can see Dr. Hoffmeister, but he's holding up a manual that is called Understanding How We Learn, a visual guide, essentially. So if you're interested in that, please be on the lookout for that manual.
So the ones that they talk about are spaced practice, which is basically you don't cram all the information, you space it out, and that requires your brain to get the information back. Interleaving, which is interacting with different topics. Elaboration, which is explaining the topic. Concrete examples, which is coming up with specific things that represent that. Dual coding, so looking at information both with words and visuals. And retrieval practice thinking about the thing to recollect it. So that's how basically I go about teaching these days, is just using those evidence-based strategies. And when you learn about it, you'll realize that our education system does not do a good job of teaching people these strategies, especially the vet students. I find it's often a little bit like, okay, so you've learned how to do well in the system so far, but unfortunately, this is not a great way to actually lead to long-term learning.
So do you find you need to use a combination of all of these things, or do you find there are students that lean more heavily into one of these modalities versus another? What do you do? What's your style of teaching?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So you can use all of these, and ultimately, you're right that some of them may work better for some students than others. Like some students really like the visual things where they get to interact with visual material as well as the text. So ideally, you want to try to have all of these involved so the students can kind of pick and choose. I personally tend to focus a lot on retrieval practice, where they'll have lots of opportunities to think of the information and retrieve it and practice it, because that like makes the most sense for me. And it's also relatively easy to do. But of course, this means that you can't just have like two exams. You know, like you've got to have quizzes throughout, and you've got to have other like small opportunities for the students to retrieve that information and use it.
So there's like the classic saying, see one, do one, teach one. Do you think that repetition like that is helpful or really works?
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I will do that as well. You know, I'll do that with our residents, especially like, okay, I'm going to show you how to do it. And then I want you to do it. And then I want you to teach someone else how to do it. So there is a role for that in terms of we have to balance out the amount of time that we have and the amount of resources that we have and the number of cases that we have with what we need to do for learning. So I'll use that as a shorthand, realizing that this person is not going to get competent with that process, right? That they're just not going to reach the point of competency with one visual and two iterations. They've done a few studies now with skill acquisition and like with surgery time, for example. I know that they've done with hemilaminectomies. I think they've done with spays. How many you have to do before you reach asymptote, where basically more cases doesn't give you any faster surgery time. And for hemilaminectomies, I think it's something like 40 or 50. You know, if we're asking someone to do a skill once and they were like, okay, now teach it and now you're good, you need to realize that that's not happening.
Do we have any evidence in like anesthesia, like how many cases, healthy or otherwise, that we need to like anesthetize before there becomes like that delta where doing more cases doesn't mean you're gaining any more, you know, practical skills?
No, that's a fascinating question, though. That would be absolutely really interesting study. I will say that I think that you do reach an asymptote, right, where it's not totally flat. There's always room to learn. Like, I saw a case last year that I'd never seen before. I'm like, I don't know what the heck is going on here. You know, called it a couple of the other anesthesiologists. We all stood around looking at this goat. We were like, yeah, that's weird. So you're always going to be learning stuff and encountering weird things. But no, I don't think we know that for even simple things like catheter placement or tracheal intubation. No idea what the learning curve is on those things.
Interesting. So again, a call for people who are interested in research, come find Dr. Hoffmeister.
Yeah, I'd love doing those kinds of things.
How effective do you find self-study is? I'm only asking because sometimes I find technicians just feel like their practice that they're working in doesn't give space to learning anesthesia skills. So they've just decided they're going to go ahead and just take it upon themselves, power themselves to like self-study, which I think is fantastic. But do you think that just learning things by yourself is helpful, or do you think it's better to kind of curate specific learning objectives to guide students through? Which one do you think, I mean, do you think you need a combination of both approaches? You know, what kind of works there?
So when I think about how to get someone to being competent at a thing, my favorite resource is this textbook called Understanding by Design, where you start with the end in mind. So what do you want to be able to do? What do you want the student to be able to do? And then you need to design the learning objectives to meet those goals. And then you need to design the instructional activity to meet those learning objectives, which is the exact opposite of how most people go about teaching, right? Most people are like, I'm going to write a lecture and this is what I'm going to tell them. And it's like, well, okay, well, why are you going to tell them that? Like, what's the goal that you're aiming for? So we got to start with the end in mind. So if your goal as a technician, you're in a practice, you're interested in anesthesia, you want to get better, I would say, you know, find a program that starts with the goal in mind. And maybe this is an in-house program. So my friend who's a surgeon, she put together a program for her technicians to get them more comfortable with anesthesia and, you know, did rounds and whatnot to help them reach that point. If it's an external source, does the goal that that program have, does that align with your goal? And if so, then hopefully they have the learning activities that lead to the learning objectives that lead to that ultimate goal. In answer to your question about the self-study, yeah, I think self-study can absolutely be done well, assuming the curriculum and the program is designed well. You know, if it's kind of haphazard or there's no accountability or you don't get feedback or you don't get opportunities for practice, these are all failure points in self-study. But if you have a program and you have an opportunity to practice it, you have the opportunity to get feedback, maybe talk to the other people in your practice, like, hey, this is what I learned. I think there's a lot of potential there. One of our techs is going through a advanced pain course. And so she'll sometimes bring questions. She's like, hey, I didn't quite understand this concept. Can we talk about it? It's like, yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, I'm thinking more of veterinary technicians that are in, you know, general practice that want to get better at anesthesia. And they ask me, like, what book is it that you always read? And I go, oh, you mean like Lumen Jones? And they're like, yeah, I want that one. And I sometimes have to be like, I don't know if that's going to be really helpful for you, you know? So I think that it's amazing that technicians want to get better. Just sometimes I feel, I find there's like a combination of like, you need to guide them a little bit about like what you're talking about, like feedback, like providing feedback. You know, I've seen you do anesthesia. I see you're weak in these areas. Here's a resource that you can use to kind of help you with that particular area.
Yeah, for sure. I think just picking up a textbook and reading it, one, it's not fun, right? You know, we need to think about like what's sustainable. So like reading Lumen Jones cover to cover is not, it's not a joyful activity. And so if it's not fun, it's going to have a hard time maintaining that motivation. And then also matching the learning activities with the learning objectives. Is your objective to be a board certified anesthesiologist? Then you need to read Lumen Jones cover to cover. If your objective is to feel more comfortable managing the cases that are in your practice day to day, that's not going to align well. So finding other resources would be essential.
So I want to ask another kind of situational question about learning anesthesia. Anesthesia can be very stressful in general, and it can be a stressful event for many learners. So for clinical anesthesia, do you think that educators should remove the learners from this environment initially when they're starting to learn new skills, kind of to improve cognitive ability and take out like the stress from impairing the ability to learn? Or do you think we should kind of be encouraging the opposite, like putting these learners in these stressful clinical situations and then with the thought of like, well, you have to think clearly under duress, so you might as well like be in this environment so that you can start learning that kind of skill. So what do you think is a better approach, or is it more nuanced than that?
Yeah. So I'll say, first of all, that there is evidence that simulation training helps with skill acquisition. So you're practicing on a mannequin or in a, you know, simulated setting. Doing that does improve your skills. So there's that evidence. I will say anecdotally, I was at Midwestern University where we had a pretty substantial simulation effort. And as part of the surgery lab, the students would do like a spay approach on a low fidelity simulation. You know, like it didn't look like an animal, but it had like layers, tissue layers. They had to use a scalpel. They had to suture and yada, yada, yada. Did it help their skills? Possibly. But until they have an animal on the table, I find the students just don't take it very seriously. And that impedes their motivation for engaging a lot with simulation. So I recognize that there is evidence for simulations. I am personally not a huge fan of simulation-based learning. What I would rather do would put students in a situation where they are really strongly supported, so they can have these feelings of stress or anxiety, but that they don't impede learning. And that we're supporting them, that, you know, maybe small group settings, we're having a positive approach to their learning, we're holding them to high expectations without being, you know, excessively critical. So I find that works pretty well. You know, in clinics, our rotations are 3 weeks, and I meet with the students at the end of each week. And at the end of the first week, they're always like, yeah, the first couple of days are really stressful, but the technicians were really great, felt really supportive. I started to figure things out, and I'm really learning a lot. So, you know, when I'm faced with that evidence, I'm like, I think this is working pretty well. Hard to argue against it.
Okay. I'm asking because I think a lot of veterinary technicians probably feel like they're learning as in like a trial by fire. So they're right away just do anesthesia on this case. And, you know, maybe they're not feeling super confident or they're very nervous. But what you're saying is that's okay as long as there is somebody supporting that person in some capacity and providing positive feedback as opposed to being critical in that situation.
Yeah, exactly. And I would say not anesthesia, but anytime you just take someone and toss them in, that's not going to be a great situation for them, you know? So if I was onboarding a new technician, you know, let's say I was a more experienced technician in the practice, I'd see about talking to the doctor and be like, hey, I want to get this new tech comfortable and trained with how we do anesthesia here. So could we have a day where, you know, maybe we have a couple fewer cases to do so that we can really take the time and make sure that they're comfortable and that we don't have time pressure on top of everything else. And that gives them the space to ask questions and also acknowledge like, oh yeah, this is different than how I've done before, how I learned in school, how do you do it? I think that the culture is probably the most important piece of that and allowing people the space to say, I don't know.
Yeah, that's probably a huge part of what we're talking about today. You know, you've taught anesthesia both clinically and like didactically in a classroom, you know, for a while now. So could you summarize, in your opinion, kind of what steps you think are best when it comes to kind of how you approach teaching anesthesia, which I know is like a huge question, but like, what's your general approach to that?
So my approach with didactic teaching as much as possible is to use active learning. So I want the students to be talking about situations. I want them to be engaging with practical problems. So I don't do very much lecturing in my lecture classes. I'll give them enough background material so that they know the assignment, they know what we're talking about. And then I'll give them like, hey, okay, so here's a case. This is what's going on with this case. turn and talk to your neighbors, chat about it for a few minutes. I'll wander around the room. If you have any questions, please ask. And then I'm going to draw you all back together and I'm going to ask you to share what your thoughts are. And then I take the information that they give me. I provide context and feedback for like, okay, yeah, I hear what you're saying. That's not exactly what I would be thinking, but you know, I understand your rationale. Or if they get, you know, really close, I'm like, yeah, that's kind of what I would be thinking for this case. Here's another possibility. So I am providing my expertise in that way. That's my preferred way to run lectures.
It's interesting. So do you give students like reading assignments ahead of time, or, you know, because students still have to know basic things like a full mu agonist versus a partial agonist, you know, to answer those types of questions. So how are you providing that type of information to students?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I try to offload as much of that out of class time as possible. So I have reading assignments with just like simple, short, multiple choice questions that really are just testing, like, do you have this basic information? Because class time is valuable. You know, I don't have a lot of class time, so I don't want to use that class time looking at the lowest levels of Bloom's taxonomy, like the understanding knowledge stuff. They can read a book for that. The university is paying me a tremendous amount of money. I'm not here to teach you what a full mu agonist is, right? You can go read that. Go hit up Wikipedia. I'm here to teach you how to use that information and make clinical decisions with it.
So let's jump into training programs then, because there's like a lot of training programs out there in the zeitgeist that technicians, they can either like purchase on their own, or maybe there's like a training program established through their workplace, you know, that claim to enhance their anesthesia knowledge and their skill sets. You know, it's possible like maybe they'll even, a technician could like earn an anesthesia certificate. You know, there's like a lot of those programs that exist. So if you're a technician and you're trying to find a training program, that would be like the highest efficacy. In your opinion, what does one of those training programs really need to have to work effectively?
So first of all, I would say I applaud you for your ingenuity and curiosity and enthusiasm. Second of all, I would say do not pay for this out of your own pocket. This should be a practice expense because it is going to make you a better employee. So I just need to open with that. Don't pay for these things yourself. In terms of what to look for, I would say, you know, I'm not very familiar with those programs, so I would probably get one of the other more experienced technicians to look at it with me, obviously the veterinarian or the practice manager look at it as well and say, you know, does this seem like something that is doable? Does it seem like this would help the practice and help, you know, with the cases that we're seeing? So I think I would just evaluate it on like a case by case basis. In terms of the, you know, learning activities, obviously, the more engaged the student is with the content, the better. So, you know, good learning activities have, again, all the things that we talked about with evidence-based learning. So the repetition, the interleaving, you know, space practice, et cetera. You know, something that had those sorts of strategies built into it, I think would be better than here's a stack of notes. We're going to give you a quiz at the end of the week. But that also might have a role depending on, you know, what kind of time you have.
Yeah, I also think like working off of what you mentioned earlier, talking about kind of getting together and deciding, you know, either as a practice manager, a technician, and the veterinarian, kind of coming together and deciding, you know, what do you want for your practice as far as a competent veterinary technician performing anesthesia? Like, what does that look like? And then deciding what objective outcomes you would require from a training program. You know, is this like a catch-all training program? You might as well just like buy an anesthesia textbook at that point and have them read it, you know, because it's just sprouting information. Or is it like, has, you know, in this lecture, we're going to talk about managing hypotension. You're like, oh, that's exactly what I feel like our technicians really struggle with. We like this program. So do you think that is a good approach, or is there something like, I don't know, is there a different approach that you would kind of take when you were assessing a training program?
Something that comes to mind for me is going back to, I think we make anesthesia too complicated. So, you know, if I'm looking at that like hypotension talk aimed at technicians, you know, you probably need a little bit of basic physiology and what's going on. But at the end of the day, the vast majority of what we do in medicine is a bunch of if-then statements. So you really just need a flowchart, you know, like, okay, you're faced with hypotension and follow this flowchart, and understanding why to follow that flowchart. That's something that I've been doing with the students for the past few years, and they love it. They're like, oh my God, this is so simple. Why didn't we learn it this way? I'm like, I don't know, because all medicine is just a bunch of if-then statements, and we could just have a computer do it all and be a lot better than us.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that. I feel like when I teach technicians how to manage hypotension, I usually tell them there's like only a few levers. There's like four or three levers you can pull. And, you know, there are some clinical scenarios you're going to pull different levels and there's in different ways. But, you know, like I'm not going to treat hypotension in a dog with a heart murmur maybe the same way I'm going to treat it in a healthy dog. But like, you know, there's just like three things you can do. You know, that's it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Keep it simple. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that's fair. So what about mentorship programs? I used to work at the University of Florida and we developed, I was not necessarily a part of this, but when we were onboarding new technicians onto the service, we created, I say we, but again, it was not me necessarily, but the zeitgeist basically created an anesthesia training program that really heavily focused on mentorship. And every week that technician was rotating with different experienced technicians on the service with the goal of, you know, there would be like a list of goals, like of skills that they would learn that week with a mentor. So do you think mentorship programs are effective for anesthesia training?
I would say that any education that is individualized is going to be better than education that is not individualized, you know? So again, my friend who's a surgeon in practice, she's like, yeah, they don't really know how to use the ventilator. And so like, let's spend time on that. You know, they're fine with like intubation and catheter placement. So we don't need to spend much time on that. So I would say, yeah, any program that's more individualized is generally going to be better. So mentoring programs where you have a one-on-one or even one-on-three sort of setting, I would expect to be a good way to do that because then you're focusing on what the learner needs.
What do you think makes a good mentor?
I think that someone who's patient is really important. It's one of the things that I'm really impressed with our technicians here is that they're so patient with the students. You know, they're like, it's okay. Like, and then they'll just explain things, you know, to them to help them feel better. You know, obviously interest and enthusiasm, like drafting someone to be a mentor who doesn't want to do it is not a good approach. So interest, patience, a certain level of competency, but I would push back a little bit on saying that that person necessarily needs to be an expert. You know, I also teach martial arts. And when I had my own school, I would routinely have like my middle rank students who have been practicing for, you know, a year or so, taking some of the new students. And it's like, okay, go teach them how to do a front kick. Go teach them how to do a center punch. And it's like, you do not need, I've been doing martial arts for 25 years. You do not need a 4-3 black belt to show you how to do a fist, you know, mm-hmm. In the same way with our vet students, like you do not need a board certified surgeon to teach you how to do a single throw on suture. You know, a senior student could probably teach you that, junior student. So I think that a mentor needs to be more competent, but does not necessarily need to be expert level.
Do you think then that mentor needs to have some humility as far as what they can and cannot teach if we're not relying on competency?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 100%. I guess that's a default assumption for me is that like we've all got to have like a basal level of humility, interest in working and emotional intelligence. That's just like you walk in the door. I assume that's what we're doing.
So if you're like going into a mentorship program, like I'm a technician and I want to get better at my skills. And, you know, this particular practice I work at has like a mentorship program. What kind of questions do you think that technician can ask to decide if a mentor is going to be like a good fit or not a good fit?
Wow. Gosh, that's so complicated for me because it really plugs into like what the culture is like in that practice and what the individual personalities are like. Honestly, and this is probably just because the lens that I view the world through is like medical error and safety culture and that sort of thing. I would probably like be like, okay, so let's say, tell me the last time a technician made an error and what the response was. And that'll actually pretty much tell me everything I need to know about that practice.
Yeah.
Right. Because if their practice is like, oh, yeah, like the vet yelled at them and there is an inquiry and, you know, is a big mess. That is a very different practice from, oh, yeah, you know, like we figured out what happened and we figured out the causes of it and we figured out how to prevent it from happening again, or at least minimize the risk of it happening again. Those are two different cultures. And one of them I want to work on and one of them I don't. That's probably like my shorthand for, would this be a good place to work? And would they be good at mentoring and all that other sort of stuff?
Yeah, that's a great response. And the follow-up question I have, which is a question I did ask, Dr. Lydia Love was on podcast a few episodes ago, and we talked about safety culture in that episode. And one of the complicated questions that I asked her, and I'm just curious what your opinion is, even though it's a little bit off topic, has to do with practices where medical error occurs. The goal, obviously, is to try to balance between doing like a root cause analysis and deciding what the problem was and how to address it, but also holding people accountable when they make mistakes, because ultimately there is a level of accountability that does need to happen. And so how can you kind of balance the two, you know, between like making sure that you're covering your practice and you're safe from liability, but also creating like this culture where it's safe to make mistakes, at least in the sense that we try to figure out what the problem is and correct it?
So I appreciate this question. I am going to push back on it and say, I don't believe that that accountability is necessary or even most of the time appropriate. Because my argument is that humans are biased. We are not rational actors, and we're in a very complex system of medicine. The reason the errors happen is because we're human and we're in a complex system. The reason it is not because you, Bob, did a thing. You, Bob, did a thing as a consequence of the system.
Right.
Now, the exception is, you know, the nurse in the UK who is walking around giving people KCL to kill them, right? There are bad actors, and those you need to find.
Right.
But the people who are at what we call the sharp end of the error, I think that the question should be raised, are they a bad actor? Especially if there's repeated problems. But more commonly, the problem is we don't have a culture where they can ask questions, where they feel like they can be heard. And so if they don't know how to do something, they're just going to try to do it. Maybe we don't have good training standards in our practice. Like, we're not doing a good job of informing these people how to manage these cases. Maybe we're all rushed and stressed and tired and overworked. You know, these are the things that I think about rather than the human being who like did the thing.
So if you could wave a magic wand, money and time are just like not a concern, and you're tasked with designing a training program within a veterinary hospital to enhance anesthesia knowledge and teach new skills, what would that training program look like?
Well, I think that some places have done pretty well with it. Let's focus on veterinary technicians, since that's kind of what the episode is primarily aimed at. I think that I would have someone who is a content expert, so like an anesthesiologist or an experienced veterinary technician, who would be able to give the information that that person needs on a one-on-one, you know, basis. Like I talked about, individualized learning is good. And then I would also have a education specialist who was along for the ride, who could contextualize the information for the learner, who could provide some tips and tricks about how to apply it and how to learn it more effectively, and sometimes like interpret the information that's being given by the expert in a more meaningful way. So that's what comes to mind for me. I think it's Nottingham in the UK has these like clinical educator people who are veterinarians, like just walking around the hospital, who are doing that very thing. Like, they're not seeing cases. They are contextualizing the cases and the information for the veterinary students, which I think is a really neat idea. So, yeah, a pretty resource intense, pretty time intense. But that's, if I could, you know, magic it away, that's how I'd go about it.
And I guess because, you know, money and time are concerns, realistically, how much time do you think that a hospital can realistically spend on educating and training either veterinarians or technicians kind of like on a monthly, yearly, daily, like kind of basis? Like what do you think is realistic?
I think for a general practice, what I would start with is someone who's interested in teaching and getting that person some degree of education in how to do effective teaching. They don't need to get a master's degree or anything like that, but they need to know some of the basic concepts for effective teaching, and then have that person basically in charge of training and be like, okay, this is how we're going to do training. And I think just that step, honestly, just having a person who is a leader in that regard for training in the practice, who knows a little bit about effective teaching, could probably design a program or a plan that would be effective for that practice. And I say for that practice because it's a little bit like with patient safety culture, like every practice has their own problems, and you can't just design a safety program for every clinic that's going to work for everyone. So having it bespoke by someone that's in the practice that knows what they're doing, I think would probably be the way to go.
Yeah, I love that idea about just starting with supporting education about education. You know, this is like a personal story, but I started my career in academia, and I think very quickly realized that I was being asked to do a lot of teaching, and I didn't really know how to teach.
Had no idea. Yeah, we're trained as clinicians, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I feel like, you know, looking back on my career now, like if I had a training program that was like, okay, so you're onboarding here at like this university or whatever, you're going to take, you know, these few classes. I mean, that, it didn't have to be like a big thing, but it could have been like, here's a few, like, you know, a few hours of basic training on like education. I mean, that would have been huge. And I probably hilariously would at the time would not have understood why it would be such a big deal. I probably would have rolled my eyes and been like, oh, more training. But like, I now recognize how valuable that would have been for me personally anyway.
I mean, for everyone that comes into academia, right? There's this persistent problem in our culture that we believe that anyone can teach, and that, yeah, whatever, you just see it and you can teach it. And anybody who's been in academia from a clinical training program realizes that's not even remotely true. We have now the Academy of Veterinary Educators, which is a group that we're dedicated towards getting educators to be better educators, basically. Yeah. And acknowledging that it is a separate skill to teach people.
Right. So do you have any like general advice for veterinary professionals? This can be technicians, general practitioners, even specialists, you know, anybody who wants to improve their anesthesia knowledge. You know, what's the best way that they can go about achieving this goal, assuming that they're already like are motivated to get better?
Listen to this podcast. You know, yeah, seriously, like NAVAS has a lot of great resources. Like, make use of those resources. There's a lot of tremendously valuable information. You know, I've done some of the NAVAS CE events, the fireside chat. There's all kinds of good stuff out there. Some of the blog posts, you know, I'd start there, like engage with that content that is with that organization, because that's one of the major goals of NAVAS. So use those resources, I would say, to start. And then, you know, just start having the conversation. Like, just sit down at a staff meeting and be like, hey, you know, can we talk about our anesthesia training? And are we comfortable with where we are? Or do we want to get better? And if we want to get better, what would that look like? Just starting those conversations, I think, would be tremendous.
Yeah, and following up on those conversations, I have to say, because I find, like, sometimes there's a huge motivation at the beginning. You know, someone goes to a conference and they like learned a skill and they want to do it. And then they get to the practice, they're like, we're all good. And everyone's like excited, but you need somebody at that point in time, like a point person, be like, you are going to be responsible for moving this forward, because you need to like, not just have the conversation, in my opinion, but also have space for somebody or allow a person to really push the program forward.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. That's a really good insight. I have seen so many things just like you described, like people get worked up and excited and start this initiative or whatever, and then it fizzles out. So having the dedication and the interest and the resources, and the accountability. Yeah.
So I know you have a podcast about veterinary education. Where can people go to find more information about that?
I do. Yeah, I have a couple of resources that may be interesting. So we have Reflections in Veterinary Education, RIVE, which is our podcast. We have monthly episodes there where we have guests, we have topics, we talk about journal articles. So if you're interested in veterinary education, definitely recommend that you look that up on YouTube or on podcasts. And I also blog at theveducator.com, V-E-T-D-U-C-A-T-O-R. So I talk about applications, interviewing, negotiation, primarily aimed at vet students and interns and residents and faculty. But there's, I think, information there that's helpful for anybody in the veterinary profession.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I found this conversation to be very insightful, and I just really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I had fun.
If you like what you heard today, I encourage you to check out NAVAS and consider becoming a member. As a member of the North American Veterinary Anesthesia Society, you get tons of benefits, including access to CE events focusing on anesthesia and pain management, blog posts, fireside chats with boarded anesthesiologists, as well as specialty technicians, and just so much more. Visit www.mynavas.org to advance your anesthesia journey today. If you have been enjoying the content of this podcast, I would sincerely appreciate it if you could give us a like or subscribe to our podcast, write a review, or simply spread the word about this podcast to your friends and coworkers. We appreciate any and all listener support. If you have any questions about this month's episode, the NAVAS podcast in general, or if you want to suggest topics you would like for us to discuss in future episodes, please reach out to us at education@mynavas.org. We would love to hear from all of you. Also, again, a huge thank you to our sponsor, DECRA, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Visit their website, www.decra-us.com, to learn more about their line of veterinary anesthesia products. This podcast was produced by Maria Bridges, edited by Chris Webster of Chris Webster Productions, and technical support was provided by Saul Jimenez. I want to thank our guest, Dr. Eric Hoffmeister, for giving his time to speak with us about anesthesia education and training. And lastly, a huge thank you to all the gas passers out there who choose to spend their time with me today on the North American Veterinary Anesthesia Society podcast. Becoming a skilled anesthetist is a lifelong journey of learning and self-discovery, so I hope you consider listening in the future. I'm your host, Dr. Bonnie Gatson, and thank you for listening. See you next month with another episode of the NAVAS podcast.